From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Deaths from opioid overdoses are skyrocketing in Florida. New information from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement shows hundreds more people died after overdosing on heroin and super potent drugs like fentanyl than in years past. Today, we'll talk with pain management doctors about how using painkillers to treat legitimate pain can quickly lead to addiction. And we'll look at the staggering number of overdose deaths linked to super potent painkillers like fentanyl and carfentanil, which are increasingly found in illicit drugs like heroin. They're so powerful, they can stop your heart in just seconds. Plus, mollusks are on the move. Sanibel's Bailey Matthews National Shell Museum is taking its education on the road with a presentation for young and old to learn more about the animals that once occupied those shells we love to hunt on the beach. We'll talk about shelling do's and don'ts and find out which shell is the rarest of them all. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Mollusks on the Move. It's a new program designed to help you enjoy Florida's wide array of shellfish without harming the creatures inside. We'll talk to the organizers of a new program aimed at educating beachgoers about how they can engage in responsible shelling. That's coming up in the second half of our program. But first, new information from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement shows opioid abuse is claiming more lives than ever in Florida. Deaths linked to heroin and more potent painkillers like fentanyl are surging by more than 70%. It's leading to an unprecedented wave of overdose deaths in several South Florida counties. But those overdose deaths begin with opioid addiction, and that's where our first guest comes in today. Joining our show is Dr. Sebastian Kwisiewicz. He's a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist at the Spine and Pain Center at Lee Health in Fort Myers. Thanks for joining the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Also joining the show today is Dr. Russell Vega, the chief medical examiner for Florida's 12th Judicial Circuit, covering Manatee, DeSoto, and Sarasota counties. Thank you for joining us today, too.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We are talking about opioid addiction and a surge in opioid-related deaths due to heroin, fentanyl, and other drugs. Have you seen this kind of addiction in your community? Share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Dr. Sebastian, I want to talk with you first about how these addictions start. You're a rehabilitation specialist, and your primary goal is to help people get off of addictive painkillers. But tell us your experiences with patients that are using opioids when they walk in the door.
Well, thank you. You're right. You know, my goal as a rehabilitation specialist is to get patients off medications. Very often I see patients who've been in chronic pain, usually back or neck pain, for many, many years. And, you know, they've tried multiple things, and they end up starting using chronic opiate medications, usually Percocets, Vicodins, which can proceed to fentanyl or other stronger medications. And the way it starts is these patients are very often in a lot of pain. Nothing seems to be helping them. And somewhere along the way, some physician gives them a little bit of Vicodin or a little bit of Percocet, and it makes them feel a little good for a couple hours. And this is what the patient seeks. They want to feel good for longer, so they start taking more and more, and then they request a larger prescription from their doctors, and they end up using it more frequently. And then it doesn't work as well after a while. The patient becomes resistant to the effect of the medication. It doesn't really change their function, but they have that maybe a little bit of pain really for a couple hours, and their body becomes so used to the medication that it requires more and more narcotics to try to cover up the same amount of pain that they used to cover up with smaller amounts.
It's kind of a slippery slope once they get started. So do you try to get them off as quickly as you can before they start needing more and more?
Well, there's a multifactorial process. First of all, when someone comes in, without any narcotics to my clinic, I usually don't try to prescribe them. But if someone has really acute pain, like after a surgery or very significant trauma, if we are going to start them, we start them on a very small dose, a very short term. We make it very clear this is going to be a short term, maybe a couple weeks. We have them come back within a week or two and just see how they're progressing. But we always underline that this is a short term medication. If they come in on medications that I've been on from previous doctors, then I usually tell them, let's try other alternatives. Let's do exercise, physical therapy, maybe some injections. Usually we use lifestyle approaches, meditation, other things, to try to control their pain and improve their function, and then very slowly we tape them off. It's usually not a quick drop, as many patients become so dependent on them, and they would have a lot more symptoms if we get them off. They have withdrawals. We usually go over the side effects that are associated with narcotic medications, such as, you know, osteoporosis or constipation or erectile dysfunction, as it decreases your testosterone level. So we use the side effects also to let them know that, hey, these are really dangerous medications, and we slowly need to get you off and try to get you to more function with other means.
So it's dangerous to do a cold turkey, take them right off of it. How do they react when you start talking to them about taking these pills away?
You know, fortunately, where I'm at my clinic, a lot of patients come because their primary care doctors send them here for specifically a lifestyle approach or something alternative to what they've been doing. So there's a few patients, when we start talking to them about these narcotic medications and getting off, that become frightened because it is something they've been so dependent on, and that's the only thing they know. So we hold their hands. You know, if someone's on 60 Percocets per month, we say, well, let's try to go down to 55, and let's try to go down to 50 very slowly. And we have them come in frequently just to kind of to help them get through this. Then there's the occasional people that are very opposed to it and get upset and will say, hey, this is not the place for me, and leave. And unfortunately, those patients we cannot help at that time.
And I wanted to ask you something about how people get on the road to using pain medications like this to handle something that maybe that could have been avoided. Do you think that finances can often dictate whether a patient gets a prescription for an opiate or whether they get an alternative like physical therapy? Because physical therapy takes time and investment.
Correct. And you know, a lot of the things that we do, like a therapy, diet, exercise, supplements, are not cheap. They're expensive. You're right. So very often when patients go out in a community and see physicians who, you know, want to do well but know that these patients may not afford other things, they might just give them that medication, which is going to give them that temporary pain relief. But again, it's a short-lived outcome because later they will need more, and later it does not provide them the relief. There's research has been shown that there is no long-term benefits of narcotic medications. And you're right, the finances, unfortunately, dictate that, hey, that this is the only thing that they can afford or the only thing their insurance will cover, which makes it more difficult again.
So it sounds like the system kind of, when you have an insurance policy that's probably a lower tier insurance policy, maybe doesn't cover things that are a little bit more long-term, like physical therapy. I mean, you can't just go two times to physical therapy and everything's
correct.
Okay.
It takes months. It takes months, sometimes years for some people. And, you know, luckily within our county, Lee County, and maybe some of the other counties out there in the country, you know, Medicaid does cover therapy, but it is a battle. I battle this every day with insurance companies that, hey, we need to get this approved or this other treatment that may be a better choice than a chronic narcotic medication. So there is options. It's just sometimes doctors may have a hard time battling that fight.
Well, yeah, your job is to try to make people feel better and try to make them well, and then another part of your job ends up fighting to get that paid for.
Correct.
Are there any other alternatives to opioids for someone with a back problem?
Oh, thousands. That's the nice thing is there's a lot of alternatives. Opioids should never be the first line, and unfortunately sometimes they are. As I said, the physical therapy as a rehabilitation specialist is usually the number one option. You know, diet, we have patients lose weight, have an anti-inflammatory diet. Sometimes there's a lot of very good supplements. There's other medications that are non-opioid related, you know, like sometimes using anti-inflammatories or some neuropathic pain medications. There's tons of different types of injections, from joint injections, spinal injections, epidurals. There's different procedures where you can burn some nerves for somebody who's got a significant pathology. You know, there's acupuncture, there's massage therapy, pool therapy, TENS unit, where we use electrical stimulation on the back. And, you know, somebody can actually purchase one. They're not expensive. You can buy one for $60 online, and it's very effective. So there's tons of alternatives that are available. We just need to educate the community and the doctors about their availability.
And the insurance companies, it sounds like, because it seems like the fastest fix that is also the cheapest tends to be those opioids that people just kind of start on and can't seem to get off. Because as you said earlier, they develop a tolerance to it and then need more and more, and it's still not addressing the problem of the initial pain.
You know, unfortunately, that's a case for a lot of the medical treatment in this country, not just opiates, but it's the fastest way to treat anything. Someone's got a thyroid issue, someone's got hypertension, put them on medication. It's the fastest, quickest, yet it's not the most effective, and it's not the long-term effectiveness, and it's got significant side effects. So we are on this conundrum, unfortunately, that medications are considered first line and fastest, but they are always, always associated with side effects. I always tell my patients, whenever you look at your pills, especially opiates, but I would say any pills, think of them, think of that skull and the cross underneath them, that every one of them is a poison. And how much poison are you willing to take?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to thank you for your time. I know you have a limited amount of time, Dr. Sebastian, so I'm going to let you get back to work. I know you have more patients to see, but I want to thank you for sharing your experience with opiate addiction with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Gulf Coast Live, and our topic today, opioid addiction and an ongoing surge in overdose deaths due to heroin, fentanyl, and other drugs. Share with us your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So how can someone go so easily from pills to needles? Nancy Dauphine is a certified addiction professional and a licensed mental health counselor with the David Lawrence Center in Collier County. And she says alcohol used to be the primary addiction that she treated, but now it's opiates. She explains how that addiction can go from prescription pills to a needle.
We quickly develop a tolerance, or often develop a tolerance, to where we need more and more doses of that medication to satisfy the opioid needs in the brain. Soon, that becomes very expensive, and you're taking so many in a day that folks often will try a more effective route to get that medication to the brain. And so usually folks might start by chewing or snorting the pills. Often folks are first introduced intravenously to using those pills intravenously. And then it's not as big a leap to something like heroin once the needle has been introduced.
And that's when you make the leap from a somewhat controlled substance to a not controlled substance. And that's how opioid addiction ultimately finds itself behind the growing number of opioid deaths in several Florida counties, including many here in South Florida. No one knows that fact better than Dr. Russell Vega, the chief medical examiner for Florida's 12th Judicial District, covering Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties. Dr. Vega, we're talking about the opioids in pill form and then heroin. Can people OD on just the pills?
Oh, absolutely. And you can overdose on pills in all the ways that we've heard described here. You can take pills by mouth. You can crush them and snort them, or you can crush them and inject them. Either way, you get enough of the drug in your bloodstream, and it can certainly kill you.
And we know that people can OD on heroin, but now we keep hearing about drugs like fentanyl. What does fentanyl and carfentanil have to do with heroin?
Well, I think what we saw, and we can debate cause and effect on these things, but what we saw statistically, at least, is after we got over the hump of prescription drug deaths that we saw both locally here in our district along with statewide and nationwide, we saw that peaking in about 2010, oxycodone pills especially in this area. After we saw that decline, it wasn't long after that that we saw the increase in deaths from heroin. And that certainly seems tempting to postulate that this is due to the pills becoming harder to get and more expensive because of actions that we're taking both at the local and statewide level to make it harder to do just that. There were the development of a prescription drug monitoring program and the barriers put in place for people to operate what we would call pill mills or facilities that really existed mostly for profit just to distribute pain pills to folks who were addicted. So once we saw the pills become less available and more expensive, then it wasn't long after that that we started to see a spike in heroin deaths. Now, once we had deaths from heroin, probably for about a year, that increase was pretty steady, and then we started to see admixed with that deaths from fentanyl. Now, fentanyl is a drug of similar in effect, actually, to, say, oxycodone or OxyContin or heroin. These are all narcotic opioid drugs that treat pain and also, you know, cause changes in the brain and addiction. And the fentanyl is much more potent, though. It doesn't take nearly as much to have the same effect. It had been really used mostly for cancer patients. It was used in short-term circumstances for surgery patients sometimes, and then cancer patients would use fentanyl via a patch that they could put on their skin, and it would deliver slow doses through the skin over a whole day, so it would give a consistent level of pain relief for people who really had severe chronic pain, like cancer patients.
So people are getting a hold of fentanyl and mixing it with heroin?
Well, we're finding that that's how it started, that we were seeing fentanyl and heroin mixed together in the same person, and these people were dying from the levels of both heroin and fentanyl in their bodies. What we were finding at that time, though, is that the fentanyl was not coming from prescription patches or other forms of prescription medication. It was being synthesized in clandestine laboratories, probably in China and Mexico mostly, but that's something that my law enforcement colleagues know a lot more about than I do. But we saw that we were seeing this sort of combination of heroin and fentanyl occurring in a lot of people. Over time, actually, that trended to deaths being caused by fentanyl all by itself. I'm not sure, but I think some of the reason for this was probably financial, based on the people who were actually selling the drugs or distributing the drug. They found that, hey, you got something which is much more potent. If you can produce it at a reasonable cost, it doesn't take as much to have the same effect in your users, so we can make more of a profit that way. So I think that's probably at least part of the reason why fentanyl started to be used more commonly. And when I say it's more potent, that's like 50 times more potent than heroin, so it takes 1/50th the amount to have the same effect. You could see why, if you could produce it cheaply, you could make a lot more money selling that drug.
But you're saying that it's more deadly and more dangerous, or does it result in an overdose 50 times more often?
Well, you know, that's a hard thing to really determine with any kind of certainty, but I would say probably no. If you know, just like if doctors know what effect they want to have, they can adjust the dose accordingly. And to some extent, I think end users of people who are addicting these drugs, they can do the same thing if they know what it is they're getting, or if the sellers know what drug they're actually selling to people. I think part of the problem is here that in the illegal drug trade, you really don't know what you're getting. And at first, there were certainly people who thought they were getting only heroin, who were getting heroin mixed with fentanyl, and it was having much more of an effect than they would have anticipated in killing a lot of people.
Yeah.
Now, we've gone from that situation to a situation where we've got drugs that are even more potent than fentanyl, which are being mixed in, and that's especially the carfentanil, which you mentioned. Carfentanil is, again, it's a similar kind of drug, but it is 50 to 100 times more potent than fentanyl, which means that just a tiny, tiny amount of this drug can have lethal effect. And so we've seen a tremendous number of deaths that have occurred starting probably in the summer of 2016. And so far, we really haven't seen we saw a little dip, but we have not seen a let up in deaths being caused by carfentanil.
So what happens when somebody ODs? Does their mind just stop? Does their heart stop? Do they forget to breathe? What's going on?
Well, typically with narcotic opioid kind of drugs, the effect is predominantly one of respiratory depression. So it's not like I wouldn't say necessarily you forget to breathe, but your respiratory drive does decrease overall, which means that you breathe shallower and you breathe less frequently as the drug has more of a prominent effect. And eventually, as that process continues, you become you reach a state of respiratory arrest where you don't breathe at all. Now, there's that effect on the respiratory system, but these drugs also work on the central nervous system in general, and they act as a depressant on that system, so they cause like sleepiness, which progresses to unconsciousness and coma and death if the drug level is too high.
And then one tool for combating opioid overdoses is Naloxone, which is sold under the brand name of Narcan. Have efforts to make that more available to combat overdoses been successful, or is it able to be used in situations where fentanyl is the problem?
Well, I think that there has been success in using that drug. Of course, we see only the unsuccessful cases here in my office. But from the information we have from first responders, both EMS and law enforcement first responders, that they are getting some success stories using the drug, finding that they are being able to resuscitate people that, based on their experience, they would not have been able to save in the past. But, you know, that being said, they're also saying that they see return customers, essentially, people who they have to resuscitate, not at one point in time, but over time, they see the same people coming back that they have to resuscitate time and again, and that at some point in time, they reach a point with that person that they don't, or they're not able to resuscitate them, even with the naloxone. So it's it does help, but it certainly doesn't prevent all overdose deaths by any stretch. And I think one other issue we have with the newer drugs, especially the carfentanil, is it's so potent, it does seem to cause death very quickly in very many of the users that we see. And if you die too quickly to get any response, then no drug is going to help resuscitate. So I do think that the carfentanil is probably much harder to be able to use the naloxone or the Narcan with.
If it happens so fast, you have to have the Narcan just kind of on standby, and that generally is not the case.
Right. You'd have to have somebody right there with the person as they go unconscious, and so many times we just don't see that. People are sometimes use in groups, but a lot of times use in solitary, and once that person goes in that circumstance, it can be very likely it's not going to be possible to resuscitate them.
Yeah. Let's go back to Nancy Dauphiné with the David Lawrence Center in Collier County. She says they are reaching out to families and communities where opioid abuse has been prevalent, and they're working to get naloxone into the hands of people who may be able to intervene in time.
We're able to provide the Narcan nasal spray free of charge to individuals who may be at risk, or family members and loved ones of individuals who may be at risk of overdose. And very much like having an EpiPen, if you live with somebody who has a life-threatening allergy, you keep that EpiPen around in case of an emergency. We're getting naloxone into the hands, or Narcan nasal spray into the hands of those folks in the communities to help while waiting for emergency medical personnel to respond. We know that with fentanyl and carfentanil, sometimes multiple doses are needed because the standard doses of naloxone in the nasal spray may not be sufficient, and we may need multiple doses because of the more potent opiates that are out there now. Making it in a nasal spray that is available and educating people through a very short, brief training program on how to use it safely and make sure that, you know, emergency medical personnel are always called first, that this is a really effective strategy, and we've seen it already working in communities nationwide to reverse hundreds, if not thousands, of overdoses, and that would have resulted in death.
And Dr. Vega, that's an interesting approach that we're hearing about that people are taking, just trying to get those distributed.
Yeah, and I can't say that I have any qualm with that approach at all. It's just it still remains a big challenge to be able to have that accessible for all the folks who might find themselves in the situation of a potential drug overdose with these drugs.
Exactly. You were on Gulf Coast Live this past summer, and you talked about the surge in overdose deaths that are linked to opioids. And the data at that time only covered the first half of 2015. And now we have data for all of 2015. And your area, and Manatee County in particular, leads the state when it comes to fentanyl deaths at 122 total for fentanyl and 61 from heroin. And there's a lag in the official data, but can you tell us what you saw in the second half of 2016 when it comes to overdose deaths linked to opioids and heroin and fentanyl?
Sure. In the first half of 2016, we saw a relatively small decrease in a lot of those kinds of deaths. And it was in the summer of 2016 when we saw the huge spike in deaths that were predominantly from carfentanil. And part of the problem we have with these drugs, too, is that with the newer drugs, and there are more than just carfentanil, but this is the most problematic one that we're seeing locally, they are very difficult to identify, or we don't have any tests to identify them. When we first found that there was going to be a likelihood of carfentanil in some of our cases, we didn't have testing that we could even use to identify it. And it took months to get the testing online and validated so that we could use it appropriately to identify these cases. Once we started doing that and looking at cases from the summer, over essentially a three-month period from July, August, and September, so far, and we're still working on cases from 2016, we've had 91 deaths from carfentanil alone. And based on the number of cases we have that we're still working on that look like they're going to be overdose deaths, those numbers are just going to continue to increase in that range. So, unfortunately, the trend from 2015 is the distribution of the kinds of drugs has changed somewhat, but the number of deaths is actually still rising.
That's like a few people a week.
We see, it seems as though we're seeing an overdose case almost every day.
That's more than a few people a week. So what do these large numbers of overdose deaths mean for people that are dealing with this on the ground, like for you and your staff?
Well, it has been a challenge for us over the last 2 to 3 years as these deaths have really spiked. Our personnel have been really stretched to the limit, so much so that we actually had to add additional staff to handle the huge influx of casework that we've had to do. There's, you know, of course, all this means that it's additional cost. The testing, we don't have our own laboratory, so we have to send out these samples to be tested to other laboratories, and we have great laboratories that we work with, but it does cost money. So it's not only an impact on the community, but yeah, it's an impact on the taxpayers and on the staff here who are doing the groundwork.
Has the budget there increased?
Yeah, we had to have a budget increase to be able to handle the increased staff that we brought on. In addition, though we cover three counties, the majority of these deaths are occurring in Manatee County. And in Manatee County, currently, we have a pretty small and relatively old facility, and its storage capacity for bodies is pretty small. And there were times during the last year when we were at full capacity and still had more bodies coming in, and we had to have those bodies stored off-site, which has a lot of challenges and is not something we like to do.
What's kind of hard to think of, too, is each of those people had a family, I would imagine, and, you know, a community that maybe saw what they were going through or maybe didn't. It's just kind of hard to imagine one person a day.
Yeah, and you're exactly right that this death affects the community in so many ways, and the family members of these individuals, you know, many times they've been dealing with the addiction for a long period of time. Many times they didn't even know, or it's a very short term thing, and this really comes as a great shock to them. You know, regardless, of course, it's just so emotionally difficult for the families to deal with this. And the investigators that work for me, one of the things that they do is try to walk these families through the whole process and explain to them how all these things can occur and the best way that they can to, you know, to cope with what's happened.
That's an unusual type of conversation that you have to have. I mean, considering that that's not how people passed away for quite some time. And then in the last few years, it's just become a new training ground for your people to have to explain those kinds of things to people, to the families.
That's exactly right. And fortunately, I think we have good qualified folks to be able to do that. And the understanding of what the folks on the other end are going through, you know, you can only have so much of that, but we certainly do our best to work with those families and explain to them sort of what the conversation we've been having here, what it is that these drugs are, what they do, and how it affected their loved ones in the end.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Dr. Russell Vega, Chief Medical Examiner with Florida's 12th Judicial Circuit. Thank you so much for your time and your insight.
It's my pleasure.
In this half hour, we also heard from Dr. Sebastian Kwisiewicz. He is a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist at the Spine and Pain Center at Lee Health in Fort Myers. And Nancy Dauphiné is a certified addiction professional and a licensed mental health counselor with the David Lawrence Center in Collier County. So I would like to thank them for their input as well. Coming up, no walk on the beach is complete without picking up a shell or two. But do you know anything about the previous resident of that shell? We'll find out about the animals that call those little beach treasures home right after this.